For giving me the opportunity to talk here today. I do notice from the audience that there's a lot of people from the University of Amsterdam in the audience today, so I weirdly feel at home. but in any case, okay, so let's get down to the subject of the talk. So what I want to, like the main emphasis that I want to bring up today, as the title says, is about understanding, basically studying quantum entanglement entropy. So this quantity as just a quantity that you could define in a QFT, it's a quantity that has been defined now maybe for more than a century that we know about the notion of entanglement, is something that in the past years has emerged as a new observable that has been very useful, that contains more data, that contains or at least different data, captures different data of a QFT compared, if you compare it to, for instance, correlation functions of local operators. So people have found it very useful in different areas and different fields of research to look at entanglement entropy and try to exploit it and try to describe a system using this. Now, I'm not going to list all possible applications of entanglement entropy and all the different ways that people are using it nowadays. What I want to exploit and what I want to elucidate is between the relationship between entanglement entropy and geometry. So this was rather novel. This was unforeseen. It was unforeseen how entanglement entropy could know about geometry, could know about geometrical properties, and its incarnation was built up in holography. So what is it that I'm going to exploit? How am I going to exploit this relationship? So the original statement was the following. So let's say I have a CFT. This is my CFT. In particular, let me just discuss CFT2s for simplicity. And let's say, okay, so here I'm drawing it in a plane, so I have some time direction and I have some spatial direction. You're entitled to pick some region, some spatial region, let's call it A, and compute the entanglement and entropy associated to that region. So this is just the Vinomen entropy associated to the density matrix of that region. The surprise that comes about in holography is that this quantity, I can compute it in a geometric fashion. So the statement that Ryu and Takanagi set up a few years ago was that if this CFT had a holographic dual, where here I'm drawing some radial direction in the interior, in this case, since I picked an ADS, a CFT2 as my setup, I would have as a dual something that will be ADS3. The proposal was that I can compute that same quantity by looking at surfaces that are anchored at that interval. In this case, since it's ADS3, this is just a curve. And the proposal is that by Ryu and Takanagi is that this can be computed as the length of this curve gamma divided by 4 times G3 Newton. And this length is minimal. So in particular here, there's a minimization condition, and this is the minimal curve, i.e. a geodesic. So this is what I mean about the relationship between entanglement and geometry. Of course, there's generalizations to higher dimensions, where instead of having curves, I would have instead minimal areas. And so it will be the area of some curve that hangs into the interior divided by, again, 4 G Newton. I can pick different shapes and so forth, but this is the most simplest incarnation of the proposal. Now, if you look at it, and if you're familiar with general relativity and other setups, this formula doesn't look too different. So it's very reminiscent, and if you want, it was inspired. Depends on who you talk to. Maybe different people have different opinions on what the motivation was, but this looks very reminiscent between the area of the black hole, which is the length in three dimensions, and its relationship to a thermal entropy. So something that we are already familiar in 3D gravity is that there's a deep connection between thermal entropy and areas of horizons. This one stands up in a different fashion, but it's very similar from that point of view, that you're relating geometric quantities to things that count either degrees of freedom, or in this case, more dramatically, a truly quantum object as an entanglement of the system. So now you can say in this arena, so this is a formula, this proposal in particular, so this is applicable if you're doing Einstein gravity, Einstein-Hilbert gravity, plus some matter. And even within this context, there's many things that you can inquire, many things that you can study about this formula. You can explore it in all sorts of fashions. It's a very current topic of research. But what I want to do is something different. So what I want to exploit today, my goal for the next hour, is to emphasize on a different aspect of this proposal, of this relationship between entanglement and geometry. So the goal for today will be twofold. So one thing that I'm going to try to exploit in this, just if you want, first just starting from a purely QFT point of view, is that I want to really revisit, and really what I want to say, I want to exploit the interplay between anomalies and entanglement entropy. And I'll be very clear, I'll be very concrete about this as I go along. But I want to really investigate again the relationship between these two quantities and try to get the most out of it. And I'll do it in this goal. We'll do both a boundary analysis from the point of view of the CFT, and we'll as well do a bulk analysis from the point of view of ADS, okay? And how these quantities are related to each other. Now, in this process, what we're going to learn, the reason why this exercise is kind of useful, is that by including different kinds of anomalies and trying to see how holography will capture these anomalies, we'll find that anomalies generically probe other aspects of the geometry itself. So in this example, in this first realization of how to compute entanglement entropy in a holographic setup, the only thing I'm capturing about the geometry itself is the geodesic length. But we'll see as we introduce more different kinds of anomalies and we have to modify the prescription, we'll be probing different kind of geometric aspects about the background geometry. So there's new data that you can encapsulate and that will be related to entanglement entropy, okay? So that's another key, I hope, a lesson towards the end of the talk. Now, you might wonder why was this our goal to start with? So what brought me to elucidating between these two aspects? And the goal is that, yeah, I have a secret agenda that I'll make not so secret, especially since I'm recorded. So the secret agenda that I have in mind is that I really want to understand the relationship. I basically want to understand this relationship. Okay? How robust is it? How is it something special about the fact that I had Einstein theory or not? Is it something that I can generalize? Is this something that I can prove? What are the features? How far does it take me? And so there has been a lot of work along those lines. And two things, what you can try to do. So in testing the robustness between EE and geometry, you can inquire about two things. So the first thing that you can inquire about, and this is something that people here at Perimeter have done, like leaded by Rob, is understand what is the effect, for instance, of higher derivative corrections. So you can inquire what happens if I modify my gravitational theory, if I don't just have a two derivative theory. And what you're aiming for, we know, for instance, going back to our more familiar setup between the entropy of the black hole and its areas, we know how to generalize S black hole to S walled. And now what we're looking for is a generalization of the L gamma that computes SEE to what you put down here. And there's a prescription about how to do it. There's many cases that have been studied, but the case in particular that we'll look at today related to anomalies is a bit more novel. But this is basically a general direction that you can pursue about how to generalize entanglement entropy if you modify your gravitational theory. How would corrections come about? How would you organize the computations? Is there a systematic way how to do it? And so forth. So that's one possible direction. The other direction that we've pursued, and I'm not going to talk about this today, but the other thing that you can think about is what about non-local interactions? So in holography, we can also have gravitational theories in the bulk that are not described in terms of local variables. They're intrinsically non-local, and this, as an example, are higher spin theories. So you could inquire how would this procedure, how would this dictionary carry out if I don't have a good notion of geodesic length, and how would we modify such quantity? And that's a topic for a different talk, but that's something else that we've been inquiring. And in pursuit of this, of my secret agenda, we found it useful to think about the problem in terms of anomalies and try to understand how much information you can extract, thinking about the problem in terms of those variables. Should I smile? No? Okay.
So yes. Are you assuming large N throughout?
Yes, I will be assuming large N throughout. So when I already wrote down this formula, I kind of secretly didn't tell you that, yeah, I'm assuming large N. Like the, you can inquire what happens, as like I said, if you have 1 over N corrections or so forth, or non-perturbative corrections. But for today, I'm just going to talk about the large N piece. For some of the simple setups, you can even say the results are valid for any value of N because the CFTs are very robust, and so you don't need to say large N in order to get in order to get an agreement between the CFT and ADS3. So I'll show you. You'll see what I mean as we go along. But yeah, in general, I'm always in a large N limit. So here, if you want, there's dot, dot, dots that correspond to corrections. Okay, so the plan will be as follows. So I wrote down an outline, but just to be a bit more concrete and say it perhaps in words. So I'm going to basically, in order to achieve my goal, I'm going to study gravitational anomalies in the context of ADS3, CFT2. So the second portion of the talk will be basically just understand how the computations of entanglement entropy are modified if you have a gravitational anomaly. And then the third part of the talk will be how to capture that same information from the point of view of ADS3. And so with that in mind, when I do the gravitational setup, I'll have to generalize Ruta-Ganagi in the presence of this gravitational anomaly. And then if I have time, then I hope I will talk about once we understand the effect of the anomalies and we understand how to set it up holographically, I'm going to put it into a test. And the test, which is a dynamical, it's a very dynamical setup. It's basically formulated in perhaps a simple way or not, is how does the holographic, so when I put an H in front, I mean the holographic entanglement entropy, which basically just means the generalization of Ruta-Ganagi. But how does the holographic entanglement entropy capture that anomalies, that certain anomalies are protected? Under RG, under a certain RG flow. Okay, so the first two parts of the talk, they're basically summarized in a paper that we wrote last year with Nabil here in the audience and Stefan and Eric. And the last portion of the talk, if I get to it, is something that is about to appear with Alex and Janet. And hopefully, yeah, I really hope it comes out in a few weeks. If I was ambitious, I would have read in May, and I'm being realistic, and probably will come out in June. That's how it's going. Okay, so I'm going to do some things explicitly, but I'm not going to provide full details of the equations and so forth. So if you have questions, if you want me to elaborate a bit more, please feel free to ask. And so at this stage, before I dive in, is there any questions? Okay, very good. So let's see. So let's start with the discussing. Okay, very good. So let's revisit the subject of computing entanglement entropy in two-dimensional conformal field theories. So the relationship, and I want to emphasize this relationship a bit between anomalies and entanglement. So this relationship, how entanglement entropy is related to anomalies, it's very evident and it's very beautiful if you're in a CFT2. And this was basically the first time that, maybe someone can correct me otherwise, but this was the first time that in a field theory, someone could compute exactly entanglement entropy without any fuss or any problem. So the computation, the most robust computation that illustrates this relationship is, for instance, consider that you have, so again, you have your CFT2, you pick some region here, A, that has some length, delta x, and let's say that you're in the vacuum state. The entanglement entropy associated to that region for that state is as simple as this. So it's C over 3, there's a log of delta x, divided by the UV cutoff. And that's it. Okay. So this is, for instance, a result that doesn't depend on any large n or anything like that. It's just an exact result. So this will be the entanglement entropy in a conformal theory. If you're in the vacuum state, you're in the plane as well. And here C is the conformal anomaly. And it makes evident that there's a relationship between these two quantities. The entanglement entropy is governed by the anomaly itself. And so it cannot be more evident. So this is an illustration of the relationship that I want to emphasize. However, this is a fine computation to do, but there's one assumption that the authors made when they carry out this computation. And basically, they neglected that there can be another anomaly besides the conformal anomaly in a CFT2. So here, the C is really the sum of two central charges that governs the left movers versus the right mover in my normalization divided by 2. And they assume that C left was equal to C right. So there's one anomaly that they're not exploiting in this problem, and is what if you have C left? So the question that you might ask is that what if C left is different from C right? Is Entanglement entropy sensitive to the fact that you have different central charges? Okay? So systems that have C left different from C right corresponds to systems where you have what I'll call a gravitational anomaly. There's various way how to encapsulate this anomaly, but just for concreteness, think of it from the point of view of the OPEs. So the only thing I will need for the purpose of doing any derivation is that this guy has an OP structure like this, and the stress tensor. So the holomorphic part of the stress tensor has that OP structure, and the anti-holomorphic part of the stress tensor has this OP factor plus the usual other terms that come about. Okay? So a system that has different central charges, C left is different from C right. Some examples of systems that display these features are basically systems that have chiral matter or purely holomorphic CFTs. So these are two basic situations where you can encounter that C left is different from C right. To our surprise, generalizing this result when C left was different to C right has never been done. And so we had to do a little bit of work to figure out, to answer this question. Does Entanglement care about this difference or not? Now, there's various ways how you can set up the computation. And so we have to, again, compute EE. And the way that we'll do it is following the same techniques that Cardi and Calabresa did, and basically use the replica trick to compute the entropy. So I'll think about Entanglement entropy as the limit, as n goes to 1, of an appropriate Renyi, where Sn is 1 minus n times the log of trace of rho n. So if you want, this is the rho a. And this, if you plug this in, you'll be able to convince yourself rather quickly that this is minus trace rho a log rho a again. But we'll think about computing the entropy, the Entanglement entropy as a limit of the Renyis. Now, this quantity here, so this is basically, you can again think of this as a particular path integral that you're computing. But as well, you can think of this, you can think of trace of rho to the n of A. Instead of thinking of it as computing a path integral, you can think of it alternatively in terms of twist fields. So instead of computing this trace of rho to the n, you can trade this problem by a problem of computing a correlation function of an appropriate twist fields that generate the branch cuts that you need. So this is basically, so this is basically a path integral on a manifold M with branch cuts. This are my twist fields. And the role of the twist fields is that they induce the appropriate branch cut. Okay, so here, just in that notation, I only wrote down the formula for one interval for simplicity. But of course, this can be generalized if you have multiple intervals and so forth. So yeah, so just one interval for simplicity. But let's think of it from this point of view. If you're computing a two-point function, or at least, well, if you have more stuff, you're computing some given point function. And what you need to know at this stage is to understand what the conformal dimensions of those twist fields are. So that's the most difficult part up to this stage, figuring out what is the conformal dimensions. And then you can see why then this answer is universal, because a two-point function is fully determined. And that's why there's no more data about the CFT that you need when you do this computation. If you just have one interval. Okay, so what are the conformal dimensions? So this is something that it's not difficult to do. I'm not going to present the details on how to do it unless, no, you guys seem okay. Okay. but if you carry out what are the conformal dimensions of this twist field in the presence of this anomaly, what you will find is the following. So you will find that it has a conformal dimension that I'll call delta, that is the sum of the left and right moving conformal dimensions that is equal to n minus 1. And not to the surprise of anyone, this is not a big shocker, since c left and c right are different, there's going to be a non-trivial h minus h bar. So, yeah, okay. That goes like this. So if you know a bit of CFT, this is not too much of a surprise. If you knew that the conformal dimension of the twist field was governed by the central charge, then it's not too difficult to convince yourself that if C left is different from C right, the twist field is also going to have some intrinsic spin associated to it. Okay, so these are the quantum numbers governed by this probe. And then the problem maps again to now saying, okay, now you want to compute it. In our case, let's just focus on one interval. You want to compute this correlation function now for an operator that has delta and s. Okay? And this is, again, easy to implement. And so some of the results in the answer to our question is, does entanglement entropy care about this? One can see that, yes, it does. And it does in a kind of fun way. So let's first do, again, the computation of the vacuum state. And as you go, through it, you'll find the following. So here set, again, so I put set I equal to 0 and set F equal to some point set. If you compute, again, the two-point function of this field for some arbitrary interval, so here, I'm picking some point set in the complex plane, the answer depends on C left and C right. You can notice that if this coordinate set is purely real, then I go back again to the previous result. So in the vacuum state, the answer depends on both C left and C right if the interval is boosted. Yes. No, so I'm being a bit sloppy between my Euclidean and Laurentian. Well, this was done, so if you go back to Laurentian signature, carefully, then it will be real. So in Laurentian signature, so that's why, yeah. So in Euclidean signature, you get an I floating around, but then you have to go back to Laurentian. And so then the result looks in Laurentian signature as you go through the. So it looked like the norm of the. So let me write down. No, let me write it like this. So if I write down set is equal to r times e to the I theta. Times kappa, where so here in Euclidean this is just an angle, but as I go to Laurentian, kappa is basically the boost parameter, how much you're boosting the interval is basically this is the rapidity of that boost, and that's the answer that you get. There might be some, yeah, and that's what you get. So if the interval is on a spatial, if you decided to quantize the system at t equals 0 and the interval that you picked was purely spatial, then you get the same answer. But if you like to travel a bit faster, then you will notice that there's some sensitivity to the answer, and it's governed by how fast you're going. Then the other thing that you can do, you can also look at a thermal state with some angular velocity. And then the angular velocity is basically doing the trick of kind of boosting you, like you're sort of spinning without even wanting to. And then this is a high temperature result that you basically obtain by doing a modular transformation from the answer in the cylinder. So in this case, when you get I was calling it R, so let me keep on calling it R. So there I don't have to boost the interval itself. The system already has the inside of it. That's basically how the answer looks. So it looks a bit more complicated, but not too much. So here beta R and beta L. Beta R and beta L are the chemical potentials associated to the left and the right movers, and here you see that there's a non-trivial dependence on each of the two pieces that you encounter. Okay, so that's what you can do. To answer my question, was it important? Is there a difference? Yes, there's a difference, and there's some very simple answers that you can get that are non-trivial and that reflect the fact that there's more structure as you have C left different from C right. Okay. You're breaking the gravitational anomaly. You can cast it in a way such that it breaks Lorentz invariance a bit. So that's why you care about in which frame you are. Yeah. So there's a preferred frame. Let's say you pick some preferred frame where you quantize the system. But then if you decide to move away from that frame, there's a difference relative to having done it in the frame where you did the quantization of the Hilbert space. So the answer is sensitive to the frame. That's what, like this piece, here it's very clear that that's what's happening. This is more reminiscent of the Cardi-like formula that you have different number of degrees of freedom associated to left and right movers. So if you take if you take the appropriate limit where the size of the system, where R is the total size of the system, and you get the thermal entropy, then this will reduce to the Cardi formula where you have the two contributions from left and right movers separately. But yeah, but the system cares, like that's the thing. This is not, Lorentz transformations are not a symmetry anymore. Or they're broken quantum mechanical.
So yeah. What kind of UV regulator do you have in mind?
So here I'm being sloppy. you, in principle, can put different UV regulators for each of them. Is that what you're wondering?
This theory can
Cannot be realized in what, sorry?
In pure 1 plus 1D.
In pure 1 plus 1D.
Usually higher.
Yeah, like you mean like you would need to add, like by anomaly inflow, like something in three dimensions? That's what you...
For example, this can be realized as a boundary of some 2 plus 1D system.
Yes, yes. Here, I can guess where the UV cutoff goes in by just dimensional analysis. So we didn't stress out too much about what was the precise definition of the UV cutoff, because we were not having in mind a specific system. We're just using symmetries to infer the answer. But if you want the places where I'm putting them, it's just from the dimensional point of view. You're bothered by this.
Likely there will be some compensating anomaly from the quantum Hall buffer that would cancel this.
Yeah.
I think that's probably true. But I think you don't need to think about that. Like the
answer yeah.
is going to find within this framework.
Because especially you're computing, from this point of view, you're just computing correlation functions of the 2D system. So the short distance behavior is not, if I'm just in the land of CFT2s and I just tell you, okay, I'm computing a correlation function for an operator that has some given conformal dimension and spin, I don't have to stress out about that. But there's probably a more intricate story if you want to do it more properly. But yeah, the way I set up the computation, I don't have to make reference to any of those arguments. But okay. So that completes the discussion of what happens in the CFT. So it follows very very naturally from the Cardi-Calabresi results. And here we're just illustrating what happens. So the difficult part of the game is to understand, for instance, how to reproduce these formulas now if you're in ADS3. So yes, sorry.
I was just wondering, so even if C left and C right is the same, you can have other anomalies, like a global gravitational anomaly?
You can have current, like you can have U1, let's say, so by global, I will say like a current. You can have non-trivial levels for currents, for instance. Is that what you have in mind?
Yeah, I'm thinking like, Gravitational anomaly comes from the diffeomorphism invariants, right? The lack of diffeomorphism invariants. We can have non-trivial, like a vacuum class group. Like when you have a topologically non-trivial diffeomorphism, you can have some kind of global anomaly.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about it. I'm not quite familiar with what you're describing. I know that you can have other, like you could have had a current algebra, so you can have R charge type anomalies, and well, for that you need to modify the observable in order to capture those. If you have non-trivial levels and so forth in the context of Ket-Moody algebras, but at least if you can encapsulate your anomalies on some statement about what happens to the OPE of the stress tensor, then it's clear how to proceed along. So, but yeah, so that's what I'm exploiting. Okay, so as a good holographer, once you do a CFT computation, you have to do an ADS computation. So let's do an ADS computation. So we had before, so now ADS3 with C left different from C right. So before, we had this formula, if we had Einstein-Hilbert. But this formula, clearly, it's not going to work. It's not going to reproduce any of these two things. And it's basically because in Einstein-Hilbert, there's a central charge that is 3L divided by 2G3. So this is the ADS radius. But C left is equal to C right. You can see that even from here that there's not enough parameters. There's not enough data to encapsulate the two, the C left and C right. There's just one coupling constant that is 1 over G Newton. So then we need to modify the theory. And the new action, the new gravitational action, goes by the name of TMG. So there's a way how you can encapsulate this difference, and it's simply by adding. So if before you had the Einstein-Hilbert term with a cosmological constant, which looks basically like that, in order to capture that, you basically add a term that looks symbolically, I'm not going to write down the indices, but it's something that depends on the Christoffel symbols. And it's that specific combination. This is what's called a gravitational Trin-Simons term. Okay? So this term has the role of mildly breaking the diff invariance. In the same way that Trin-Simons theory are almost gauge invariant up to some boundary term, this term mildly breaks the diff invariance by a boundary term as well. And if you have, this is something that was done before, if you have spacetimes that are asymptotically ADS3, the generalization of the statement that Einstein-Hilbert has central charge equal to 3L over 2G is now that you have C left equal to 3L over 2G3 of 1. And this one I wrote like this. Now you get these two central charges, and here this coupling mu is coming from this coupling to this to this gravitational Trin-Simons part. Okay, so this is known. It was known how to induce C left different from C right in the bulk, and that's the answer. But now we have to understand how to compute entanglement entropy in this theory. Okay, and it's this one. This part over here is always associated to this guy, and now, but now we have a different action. So how do you do that? Okay, so there's two ways how to do it. And I want to keep the middle one so you can still see it. So there's two routes to get this formula. So one of them is basically to evaluate, so to use the conical singularity method. So this basically means that you interpret what the way that you're thinking about the problem gravitationally is thinking about computing this Sn, which is basically, if you want, you're thinking of this trace of rho to the n as some gravitational path integral. And then as you take the limit n going to 1, this gravitational path integral reduces to the action on a cone. And this was basically done in a very formal and systematic way, or at least the rules how you would proceed with this. Well, they go back to Solodukin and even further back when people were computing black hole entropy, how to do it using cone actions. But in the context of entanglement entropy, this was revived by Lekovich and Maldacena. And basically, you think of this problem like this. So you have some gravitational path integral. You have your appropriate manifold. You take the limit and go into 1, and there's going to be some action of the cone. If you do it for Einstein-Hilbert, you'll get that the action of the cone is basically just the length of some geodesic. And now you will say, well, now I have a different action. And then you carry on. So you can do it that way. And we did it. But I think it's the most an illuminating way of how to explain the problem. It has its some drawbacks that I'll explain as I go, but this is one route that you can take. Route two is to cheat. I like to cheat. So there's a better way how to figure out what the answer to the problem is, and by cheating I mean guessing the answer. From the CFT, okay? And it will show each of these two methods. They complement each other, and you can, with the two of them combined, you can declare that you succeeded, or me and my collaborators claim that we succeeded. Okay, so let's cheat. And then if you're curious about this other method that is a bit more, well, it's whatever. We can talk about this offline. Okay, so let's cheat. And that's why I wanted to keep that blackboard there. So okay, so on purpose, I wrote down what the quantum numbers of the twist field were. So we had a delta. So let me write down this delta in some small c expansion. So, sorry, small in the expansion of n going to 1. So it looks like this, plus order n minus 1 squared. If I write it in terms of gravitational variables using those values of C left and C right, I will get that this is L over 4g, 3 newton times n minus 1, plus dot, dot, dot. And then for the spin, similar formula, C left minus C right over 12. And then this guy is 1 over 4, g, 3, n minus 1. And so now we go back to the RT proposal. And we say, OK, the RT proposal told us to compute geodesics. What are geodesics? Geodesics are basically paths followed by massive probes. So in particular, this L gamma over 4G3, I can view it as the action of some massive probe with its proper length times some velocity. Okay? And if I look at here what the mass would be, the mass is 1 over 4g3. And if I ignore the n minus 1, this is basically the conformal dimension of the twist field in ADS units. And this tells you, the massive particle in the bulk is basically this heavy operator in the boundary. That's kind of nice. And so now we can cheat. And so now you say, OK, now I want to do our version. So we want to do this computation of holographic entanglement entropy with this anomaly. And so if I look at this part of my analogy, then you will say, well, instead of having a massive probe, now I have spinning probe. So and if I needed to guess what the mass and the spin of the probe are, I would say, okay, it's still 1 over 4g3 according to this, and it has the particle has a spin that is 1 over 4 mu g3. So those are the characteristics of the probe. What I would put here, well, instead of geodesics, spinning probes follow different paths. And so I have to tell you here, I have to tell you what are the dynamics. Okay? So what is the, how do I minimize an action for a spinning probe? So this was done a long time ago. It was actually in general relativity, understanding how to describe particles, probe particles that have mass and spin. It was actually discovered three times, not just one. So for short, it goes under we call it MPD. So this is Matheson, Papapetru, and Dixon. They all did it in different decades. Some of these, the first one is in French. So unless you know French, you can read it. I couldn't. But the other two are in English. The middle one is actually the nicest one. The Papapetru paper is very nice. It's from the 50s. And he told us how to describe the dynamics. What is the generalization of a geodesic if you have something that is spinning? Okay. So basically, you think of a particle of a stress tensor. So in this case, you think of a massive probe as a stress tensor that is a delta function. And here, the layer that Papapetru added was saying, OK, let's think that there's a dipole moment as well for the stress tensor. And the answer is as follows. So if I just had geodesic dynamics, I will have an equation that looks basically like this. So it will be the covariant derivative of the velocity of the particle is 0. That's the geodesic. The new layer that you add as you add the spin is that you get that term. And here, instead of having 0, mu, rho, sigma, nu. So that's an equation for a particle spinning. And I introduce here a new quantity. The spin tensor of the particle is an antisymmetric tensor. And it's basically the spin of the particle is basically the constant that normalizes this 2 tensor. And it depends. It's basically dependent on the normal vectors to the curve. So if I have a particle that has some curve that I've been calling gamma with some tangent vector v mu, and these guys are the normal vectors to that whirl light. Okay? So these are the new dynamics that you need to describe. Now, it's nice to write it in terms of these ends for a reason that I will say in a second, but really here I'm not adding a new degree of freedom. So this guy, if you go through a few steps, is basically just the volume, the transverse volume for the whirl line. So this is just a more complicated equation for the velocity of the particle. It's even more nonlinear than it was before, and it couples to the Riemann tensor of the background itself. Yeah, these are classical spinning particles. So the spin doesn't have to be quantized at this stage. It can be a continuous parameter.
Just to understand, the Earth rotating?
What's that? No, this is not a geodesic. This guy is not going to follow a geodesic. This part is just the geodesic part. So this is the geodesic equation. But if you say that the particle has spin, then you add these two additional terms. A spinning object, no, it doesn't have to obey the geodesic equation. No. Yeah, so you're adding a little bit of like width to the object. Yeah, so it can probe like that's, yeah, it's kind of widened a little bit, but in an epsilon matter. So you're kind of like widening it, but not making it fully like string-like object. So yeah, so the object now, this guy does not follow a geodesic at all, unless there's very special circumstances that I'll illustrate above. But generically, this is the equation, and it's much more complicated. But this was our proposal. And you can also, so this is the dynamics. And now you can ask about what is the functional. And so the action for this probe, so before, you had that the action that gave you the geodesic equations was the proper length of the curve. So that would have been the action that if you extremized it, it gave you this piece. And now there's two extra pieces that you need to add. And then you also have to add some constraints. And these guys assure that n is orthogonal to n tilde and is orthogonal to v. And if you extremize this functional, including the constraints, you'll get the full, you'll get this equation. Okay. Now, this is where the two methods start complementing each other, and now I'm running out of time. And of course, I'm not going to get to the last part. But this is where the two methods complementing each other. So here, for instance, I just guessed what the answer had to be. The nice thing about the guess is that it told me what the dynamics were. It told me, you know, like without much ambiguity, okay, this is the natural dynamics of this curve. And we constructed a functional that gave that dynamics, but then you can see that this functional that now we will declare that will compute entanglement entropy, provided that you give these values to the mass and the spin, you can see that that functional matches the action of the cone. If you just evaluate the cone, the problem, it's difficult to see what the dynamics is and the nice interpretation of spinning particles, because you make too much choices as you evaluate the action of the cone. It's not super covariant. But if you doubt my guesses, they can be corroborated by explicitly evaluating the action. And okay, that's what you get. Now, this piece here has an interesting interpretation. So this piece is really coming from this gravitational Trin-Simons term. And you can view this term. This term is basically measuring the torsion of the curve. And this is what I meant by measuring different quantities, different geometrical quantities associated to the background itself. So before, we were just measuring a length of a curve. Now, when we add anomalies, we're really capturing a different set of data that is the torsion of the curve. So basically, this guy is telling me how much the normal vectors process as I go along a curve. So let's say I have some curve doing something funny that it's anchored. So here I'm drawing, this is like the bulk direction. And I think, okay, my perspective is not super good, but the boundary, like, there at the anchored here. So here's the CFT. And basically, with some choice of n that you start here, you parallel transport them, and you see how much, after you parallel transport them, they move around. And so they're telling you how much this guy is twisting around as you move. So that's what this guy is doing. In the language, if you want a more Trin-Simons-like language for this term, this is the frame anomaly, or it's related to the frame anomaly in Trin-Simons. But okay, if you don't know what that means, don't worry. This is the geometric interpretation of that new piece. So it's kind of neat. By adding this anomaly, you added a new piece. If you solve for it, another comment that perhaps is worth saying is that and this might generate some confusions, provided what I was just asked, is that if you're an ADS3, it happens to be the case that this coupling vanishes. So V contracted, V with S and R, that particular contraction there, just because ADS3 is too symmetric, it's equal to 0. And it's actually easy to solve the equations in this case. So you can tell from the structure of the equation, since S is just proportional to V, you still get that a solution to MPD. So in that case, it was easy to solve. But even though the solution is the same, the functional, evaluating the functional is kind of different. So OK, I don't have much more time. And so I just wanted to say that so I wrote down up there for you. That is the middle one. So for instance, we evaluated in the CFT those two answers. You can do as a test. For ADS3 with C left different from C right, our action for the probe, our spinning probe, gives full agreement with the computations of entanglement entropy, like in those two cases there. So you'll be able to see that the agreement is clean and really nice. And that's what you can do basically in ADS3. Check some of the universal answers and go back and forth. Now, the only thing I wanted to say about the last portion, about these fake gaps, that I think maybe I won't have time to say it. So if someone asks me, I'll illustrate what I was going to say. But it was basically understanding, if you have a non-trivial background, just the 2 cents. So this was section, I don't know, 4 or something. So if you had a non-trivial, non-ADS3 background, would any of these observables, would the gravitational observables, in particular, entanglement entropy, but you can also think about the linearized spectrum, be compatible with the fact that C left minus C right does not flow. So basically, in general, in holographic setups, you can construct backgrounds, which in the IR would naively have a mass gap. But if you have a non-trivial difference between C left and C right, it should be impossible to generate a mass gap in an IR theory. So we were trying to really see how that worked, because these domain wall solutions were still solutions of the theory that we had to start with. And so it's a question not to the geometry itself, but to the observables to actually illustrate that this quantity is not, you cannot ever make it flow. But OK, that I notice now I ran out of time, so I can't explain that. But you feel free to ask me questions, and I'll elaborate on this point. So to conclude, so just a few remarks. So we worked out in a lot of detail the case of CFT2s, which is not super difficult, but it was something that had to be done. But you can ask yourself what happens in higher dimensional CFTs. So for instance, every time that you have 4k plus 2, you can have these kind of anomalies. So in the land of QFTs, if you have even dimensions, you can have anomalies that are either, that can either be, depending a little bit more in details of the dimension, gravitational, or you can also have some that are mixed with, for instance, a U1. And you can inquire what is the relationship between entanglement and anomalies in that more general setup. And from the bulk point of view, one could inquire if this cheat that I presented of having a spinning probe in the case of ADS3 would be mapped to something like a spinning membrane. So I know some people here in the audience are working on that. So hurry if you want to do it. But I think this is something that has not been exploited enough, and I think it would be something nice to illustrate. Other cases where you can do it as well, where you get a lot of simplifications. In particular, you get simplifications in trying to solve these equations, are cases where you just have conformal gravity. So that's kind of nice. But one thing that I think is something that is a task for holographers in particular, is to understand really how to implement this prescription, this Rutteck and Agee prescription, if you have theories that are more non-trivial. So there's this equation, if you look at it, it's a higher derivative equation for the position of the probe. So generically, you will have more solutions. They're not just going to be one surface that minimizes, that extremizes the functional. So you might inquire, what is interpretation of the additional saddles. And this comes into really understanding how to derive this Ryutaganagi formula from first principles. Because there's many cases where people have encountered that the more minimal saddle is not something that is smoothly connected to, like, the geodesic case. And it's not clear what the rules of the games are in terms of minimizing those functionals. So that's something that I think it's very much along the lines on having a proof of what is the connection between entanglement entropy and geometry. Or if you don't want a proof, or something more constructive along the lines of how you relate, for instance, wall entropy to thermal entropy. So these cases are rather explicit, and you can flesh out how the correspondence will go and elaborate more on what the prescription is. So yeah, so that's all I have to say for today. Thank you.
Can you comment about going beyond the classical limit?
So yeah, that's a bit difficult. Usually how people have gone, like if you wanted to, for instance, compute a quantum correction. Yeah. So one way you can do it, it's not the most energy efficient way, is to think of it from this point of view. So compute quantum corrections to this, to the Renyi. And then take the limit. So for this, that if I tell you that you're computing some path integral, some gravitational path integral, then a quantum correction is just a one loop determinant correction here, and then you will take the limit. But that's, it's like the most horrible task that I can give you to do.
The spin in particle, anything to
that? Well, this guy, that's the thing. This. Yeah, that's the thing. If you're just an ADS3, okay, it depends a little bit on the background. But if you are just an ADS3, the C left minus C right doesn't get corrected. That's the only term. Ah, no, but that's also classical. Sorry. No, yeah. This doesn't help me. This was not a quantum correction that I was computing. Well, you can say which one is bigger or smaller depending on the couplings. But this doesn't help me in terms of computing a quantum correction to the result. Yeah, it's just that, like, what I'm thinking about is that if you're just in backgrounds that are ADS3 and you just have, like, one interval, the quantum corrections are kind of boring. Because they're just renormalizing C, the sum. But they won't renormalize the difference. So the difference between the central charges, it's just an exact. If you declare that you had some difference, then you don't get correct. You get corrections to the sum of the two of them. But that depends on the background. I'm just saying that there will be very specific backgrounds where you're not going to get a correction. But if you change the background, or if you put a setup where you have more intervals, it will get corrected. Yeah. But there's very special cases where it doesn't. There's no correction to this. So for instance, if I computed the entropy of a BTC black hole, the C left minus C right part of that entropy is just protected. And there's no interesting correction to that formula. At least in the 1 over n expansion. There can be phase transitions and other things happening, but as the entropy of a given saddle, that quantity is robust. It's the only quantity at the classical level that you can add. But yeah. So that's something, that is something that I think we are able to do better, actually, in the context of the higher spin theories. So in that case, I can tell you what this entanglement entropy is as a quantum operator in the bulk. So in that case, what we did, we said we're computing a Wilson line in the bulk. And I know how to treat that as a, like, I would know how to quantize that object. I don't know how to quantize geodesics. That's why I'm, or I don't know how to quantize a spinning particle. Like, I don't know what that is as a fundamental object in a theory, in a more glorified theory. But in the case of the higher spin theories, even though, yeah, we kind of don't like those theories for other reasons, but in that case, our proposal is an object that has, it's a well-defined object that within a transimens theory, I know what it is, I would know how to compute its expectation values, how to evaluate corrections to it. And if you ask me how to compute quantum corrections, that's something where I can foresee, yes, this is a systematic way how you carry it out. But the lack of that proposal is that it doesn't work for, it only works if the connections that are supporting it are flat. It doesn't work for the most generic gravitational background. So, but yeah, quantum corrections in this context are very difficult to capture. It's not clear how to, there's a good systematic way. There's been discussion, and like Aaron Wall, for instance, and also Maldacena and collaborators have tried to address this question, but it's all because, yeah, your starting point is a geodesic length, and there's, I don't know how to extract quantum information from that. Yeah.
So essentially, the faster this particle spins, the higher the difference between the left and the right center charge.
Yeah.
Is there some constraint, classical constraint, on what can be the difference between the left and the right center charge?
Yeah, so basically, yeah, so the constraints are basically given by, if you require that the central charges are positive, and you design on some sign of mu L, mu times L, basically, yeah, you can work it out, but there's, if you want both of these quantities to be positive, then this guy ranges from 1 to infinity. And then you can, yeah, this is a gravitational computation. Like, well, the spin of the particle, okay, you have to be, I'm being a bit loose, but okay, are you asking me how, what is the, if there's a maximum bound on the spin of the particle? Maximum velocity. Sorry, you need to define velocity for me now. So you can ask, you can inquire, like, if there's a bound on this parameter s, which is the spin of the particle. That's something that you can ask. It doesn't have a definite sign because it depends on the orientation that it goes. But if I make it spin too much, then it will start back reacting. That's something that you can. So you can try to adjust it such that its back reaction is not super large. But in principle, it can be, and there might be some, no, I don't think there's any unitarity bounds on this. So yeah, because if I have a theory, for instance, where I just have, where this guy is zero, then the mass is equal to the spin. And it just depends on how big the central charge is. That's something that you can adjust. So if you have a theory that is purely chiral, at this level of treating the equations in this way, there's no obstruction on how much spin you can give to the particle. So yeah. And most of you might worry that if you take mu to zero, then one of the central charges goes negative. But and that's what I would call conformal gravity. So it's a non-unitary theory, but it's formally a limit that you can take, where the total central charge is zero, but c left is equal to minus c right. But yeah, in terms, you can make the particle from this point of view, because I haven't quantized it. That's the thing. It's still, I'm treating it classically. But from the consistency point of view, it would be back reaction that if you make it too heavy or you make it spin too much, at some point you should be consistent and see how the back reaction affects the motion of the particle itself. So yeah, so at this stage, I'm just treating it as a probe.